The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You're listening to Washington Post Live's First Look podcast with Jonathan Capehart.
Welcome to First Look, Washington Post Live's one-stop shop for news and analysis. I'm Jonathan Capehart, associate editor at The Washington Post. There were some key primaries this week that were bellwethers for Republicans, for Democrats, and for Trump. Let's dive in with Washington Post national political reporter Annie Linsky. Annie, welcome back to First Look.
Hi, glad to be here.
All right, so what was the big headline from Tuesday's primaries?
I think sort of January 6th, election deniers won statewide in two important states, North Carolina and Pennsylvania. So, you know, to me, that was the big takeaway, that the Republican electorate has not tired of this conspiracy theory pushed by Trump and his supporters. So, you know, in North Carolina, you had Ted Budd, a congressman who voted to sort of discount the 2020 election. He was voting in the chamber. There was a person, Doug Mastriano, who was marching in Washington that day at a Stop the Steal rally. And he won the Republican nomination to be governor of Pennsylvania, which will set up a really important showdown in November. So to me, that was the biggest takeaway. But I think we also learned a lot about the importance of Trump's endorsement and the limits of Trump's endorsement.
Mm. Okay, so great. That anticipates my next question. So what did the primaries mean for Donald Trump and his power within and hold over the Republican Party?
I think what it showed is that Trump's endorsement is obviously good for these candidates. I shouldn't say obviously. His endorsement is good, but it's not determinative. If you look at North Carolina, Ted Budd, who was vying in a very crowded field to be the Republican nominee for Senate in North Carolina. The thing that set him apart from this field, which included former Governor Pat McCrory, so it was a competitive field. The one thing that set him apart is he had Trump's endorsement. And you could see that in some of the data that the Club for Growth shared on their website. It showed that voters who knew that Ted Budd had Trump support, he was winning those voters by 30 points. But voters who did not know that Budd was the chosen candidate by Trump, he was losing those voters by 32 points. So just the Trump endorsement in North Carolina was important. Also, you had Republicans aligned there. The Club for Growth, which has been feuding with Trump in other places, was also backing Ted Budd. So, you know, there's an alignment. You look at somewhere like Pennsylvania, and it's just a lot messier. The Republican kind of apparatus was sprawled all over the place. You had big backers for other candidates, particularly David McCormick. And that the Pennsylvania Senate primary is still undecided. It's like within 1,000 votes right now. And there, Trump's candidate is, you know, Trump's endorsement certainly lifted his candidate, but we don't know what the results are yet. Mm-hmm. So it was a mixed result for Trump himself. Trumpism, though, did quite well. And, you know, in Pennsylvania, if Trump's designated candidate, Mehmet Oz, if he loses, it's going to be because there is another Trumpier candidate from the right, Kathy Barnett, who took a lot of those Trump votes away from Oz.
Well, let's talk more about Pennsylvania and the gubernatorial primary race. You talked a little bit about it. This is Doug Mastriano, who he was here in Washington during the insurrection. He tried to overturn President Biden's 2020 victory. He got Donald Trump's endorsement, and he won far and away. The Republican Republican nomination. So I guess the question is he likely to prevail, become the next governor of Pennsylvania against the Democratic challenger, who is Josh Shapiro, who is the sitting attorney general of the Commonwealth?
Well, I think we've got a lot of time between these, until November. I think that one should remember, Mastriano is the candidate that Josh Shapiro, the Democrat, wanted to run against. Josh Shapiro put $500,000 into advertising for Doug Mastriano. He was trying to lift up this candidate because he felt like he'd be somebody he could beat. That is a very dangerous game to play. Mastriano, Mastriano, it is unclear that he would, sign a certification in 2024 for the electoral votes in Pennsylvania. To have Pennsylvania potentially governed by somebody who was a leading voice for overturning the election in Pennsylvania in 2020. I mean, he was on the phone with Trump's lawyers. He was on the phone with Trump. In his rallies, in his sort of the final days, he brought in some of Trump's lawyers who appeared virtually at rallies for him. I mean, this is somebody who is not just following the conspiracy. He's a leader of the conspiracy.
Right.
So there's going to be a real contrast between him and Shapiro. But I think, it's a very cynical game of Democrats to, at one point sort of fret about democracy and then on the other hand, be the largest funder of a candidate that very clearly has outside of the norm views about democracy.
Right.
So I think John Shapiro deserves to be called out for that.
Right. Called out for it. And the key thing you said is that he's playing a very dangerous game because not only would a Governor Mastriano be able to mess with the certification, the governor of Pennsylvania is the one who appoints the Secretary of State who oversees elections. That person is not elected as they are in, say, Georgia. And that person is beholden to the electorate. So, yeah, it is a very dangerous game. Annie, in the time that we have left, I want to talk about something that you have reported, and that is there are all these people in the White House around the president who have tested positive for COVID, and yet the president continues to test negative for COVID. Why is that? And what does that mean about how much time he actually spends with people?
Well, it's even more than that. It's, Biden has tested negative for COVID, and obviously nobody wants the commander-in-chief to test positive. It would be terrible.
Right.
But Biden also hasn't even had a close contact with anybody who has COVID, right? So a close contact by the definition of the CDC is spending 15 minutes in the presence of somebody who, within 2 days then tests positive for COVID. And the White House is saying, well, this has never happened. They have said that they would report any close contact that Biden had. And seemingly he is not spending 15 minutes with a whole slew of people who later get COVID, including his Secretary of State, his press secretary who got it twice, his more recent press secretary who got it once, but not just his aides, also his sister got COVID. Biden was not a close contact. His daughter just got COVID, and Biden, again, not a close contact. So you do kind of wonder, who is this president spending time with? And it is this sort of constant reminder of how lonely it would be to be president, particularly right now. And he is in this very protective bubble because, his aides, nobody wants him. He's a 79-year-old president, and for him getting COVID would be a really big deal. So they are doing a good job protecting him. It's just the cost in terms of personal isolation seems to be, rather extraordinary.
Within the White House, though, and yeah, you describe a very lonely picture for anybody. But, when that person is the president of the United States, you really kind of got a feel for the guy. But the president right now is over. He's in Asia. He is in Korea. Do you think that the ability of the president to now actually leave the confines, not only of the White House and of Washington, but the country, to get out and meet with leaders and meet with other human beings is something that is leveling for the president's isolation.
Potentially. I mean, he has, you know, done some foreign trips before. You know, most sort of the most fun event, as far as I could tell, was his in when he was at the G20. There was a giant gala in Rome that was beautiful, and the president was supposed to be there for 20 minutes. And I was sitting in the van outside, and he was definitely there for more than 2 hours. So, you know, yes, getting around, he is doing that. But, you know, just the fact that, you know, this definition of close contact is very specific, and it's 15 minutes mm-hmm. with somebody, even if you're both masked. So it is, you know, surprising that not even that he hasn't had it, but he hasn't been in close contact with anybody who's had it.
Right. The close contact thing. It's like we're all on timers whenever we're with somebody. Annie Linsky, as always, we are out of time just as we are, you know, we get going with our conversation. Annie Linsky, Washington Post national political reporter, thank you, as always, for coming to First Look. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too.
All right, we're going to keep the conversation going with the Opinions Roundtable in just a moment. Let's go to the opinion side of the Washington Post, where we will find Washington Post associate editor and columnist Eugene Robinson and columnist Josh Rogan. Welcome to you both. Welcome back to First Look.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Thanks, Jonathan. Good to be here.
All right. So I was just talking to Annie about some of the primary races that happened on Tuesday. We talked about Pennsylvania and a little bit about North Carolina, but let's keep talking about North Carolina, where Congressman Ted Budd thanked Donald Trump for his endorsement in his victory speech to be the Republican nominee for Senate. Have a listen.
So when President Trump endorsed me last June, he said this. He said, Ted, I'm endorsing you because you never wavered on America First policies. That America First agenda, it led to historic job growth, wage growth, and prosperity for all Americans.
So, Gene, will that message carry Congressman Budd from the House to the Senate this fall against his Democratic challenger, Judge Sherry Beasley?
Well, it could. I mean, it's North Carolina. Basically a red state. I mean, North Carolina's been changing, and North Carolina surprises us sometimes. But I would say Budd is favored right now to take that seat. And I think that you know, he credits President Trump for lifting him to his primary victory. But I think it's more important in North Carolina that he's a Republican, full stop. And that gives him an advantage going in, and we'll see how Beasley does and whether she's able to eat into that advantage.
Yeah, let me stick with you for 1 second, because you know what, I'm gonna hold that question. I'm gonna hold the question I was gonna ask you and go to Josh. Josh, in terms of Donald Trump, how large was his footprint on Tuesday's voting?
Right. Well, I think it's pretty clear that it was less significant than he would have wanted and than people might have expected. I mean, just look at the map. You've got Dr. Oz, you've 100% name recognition, unlimited money, and the Donald Trump endorsement. And he didn't even get more than, you know, 60% of the MAGA movement, much less beat a hedge fund manager with ties to China. Look at, you know, the Trump endorsement of some non-MAGA Republicans like Morgan Ortegas in Tennessee 5th. The Republican Party drummed her out of the ballot. And then look at Madison Cawthorn in North Carolina, who's got to start a dark MAGA because the Trump endorsement didn't get him above his issues. So it really was more about the candidates. Look at David Perdue. There's just a lot of examples. And the examples where Trump put points on the board, he totally violated what he just said to Ted. It wasn't about MAGA at all, because he dumped Lou Bardella in Pennsylvania, and who was as MAGA as you could get, because he saw that he was going to lose. So, you know, this strategy of Trump trying to gamble and come up with numbers not based on any calculation of policy, much less the welfare of the constituents of his movement or the people that are in these districts, it's a numbers game. But when he wins, it's more luck than anything else.
You know, I was going to ask if you think then, since there doesn't seem to be any science or rhyme or reason to his endorsement, is it just Donald Trump trying to figure out, okay, this is the guy who's going to win and I want to be with the winner?
Right. Well, it's also the MAGA people trying to figure out where Donald Trump's going to end up, because it's hard to have a cult of personality when you don't know if what the cult leader is going to do next. So you don't know how to get to where he's going to land. So it's confusion both ways. And the fact that Trump is so capricious and changes his mind all the time, that's what sows all the confusion. And of course, the MAGA movement, as Kathy Barnett in Pennsylvania said, doesn't belong to Trump. And he created a monster, and then he lost control of the monster, which is like the story of every book and movie I've ever seen.
Gene, let's turn our attention to Pennsylvania, where the lieutenant governor, John Fetterman, he won the Democratic nomination for Senate from his hospital bed. And a lot is being made of the fact that, you know, he has this everyman persona. That being said, will that be enough for him to flip that Senate seat, given the strong headwinds for Democrats all over the country this cycle?
Well, it could be, actually. I mean, Fetterman demonstrated that he is a good candidate for Pennsylvania. I mean, this sort of, you know, working class persona, or it's just the way he is. He's not polished. He doesn't measure his words very carefully. He wears, you know, Carhartt outfits. He is...
And basketball shorts, Dean. Basketball shorts.
Yeah, he wears basketball shorts. He is, you know, a regular guy in appealing to a regular guy state. He ran away with the primary. I think he has a real shot at taking that Senate seat.
Mm-hmm. And Josh, sort of a follow-up to the question I asked you, it's a follow-up to what I just asked Gene, and that is this. If you're John Fetterman running to flip a Senate seat, do you want President Biden coming into the state to campaign with you? I mean, especially given the president's really low job approval ratings.
Right. Well, you know, Jonathan, I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia, and I'm here to tell you that Pennsylvanians love Joe Biden. Okay. They consider him a hometown guy, and that's always been the case, and it'll always be the case. So don't extrapolate anything from his national poll numbers. He's big in Pennsylvania. You want him on that stage. You need him on that stage. And, you know, the other thing I know, having spent the first 18 years of my life in Pennsylvania, is that it's basically a center left, center right market. Okay. And so if Fetterman runs in the middle and, you know, doesn't make any big mistakes, and we all wish for his continued recovery, I think he has a really good shot of taking this thing, because, you know, Pennsylvania will move back and forth between sort of the 40 yard lines, but it never goes too far to one side or the other.
This is interesting. I mean, you know, folks who are watching, you don't know this, but Josh is kind of he's a tough guy. So the idea that he says that Fetterman actually has a shot, and actually sounds kind of optimistic, that is a big deal. All right, Gene, all politics is local, but will abortion be a galvanizing issue for Democrats in the midterms?
Well, if it is, it'll be the first time. I mean, it'll be the first time that Democrats have been able to mobilize around this issue the way Republicans and the anti-abortion movement have done for years and years. With the impending demise of Roe v. Wade, is there a Democratic Party single issue voter there that's going to really be motivated in a way that the voter was not motivated before? We don't know the answer to that. Historically, you wouldn't put a lot of money on abortion becoming that, a wave of Roe v. Wade carrying Democrats to some big victory. But it's so difficult these days to predict politics because the old rules don't seem to apply anymore. So it's a possibility. We're going to have to see this develop over the next month. And we're going to have to read the actual decision when it comes out, too.
Right. Right. So then, Josh, I'm going to give you kind of the same question. All politics is local, but is the economy the issue driving the midterms over all, any other issue we could possibly discuss, including the official Supreme Court ruling on whatever it's going to do on Roe v. Wade?
Listen, I think the economy is a huge issue, but it's just the latest in a cascade of crises that have put a lot of pressure on a lot of Americans and people around the world. The pandemic, the energy crisis, the food crisis, the baby formula crisis. People are frazzled after 3 years of what has been a very, very strange and dystopian time in all of our lives, and they look for change. And, you know, President Biden was elected largely on a pitch of a return to normalcy. And although most of these things are really out of his control, if we're being honest, a return to normalcy is far from what we've got. So I think, you know, voters in that situation will always try to turn to an alternative. And so I think that that bodes very poorly in November for Democrats up and down the ticket.
Let's turn our attention to Ukraine. Yesterday, the Senate passed another $40 billion military and humanitarian aid package for Ukraine. Eugene, I'll start with you. The significance of this additional aid package?
Well, it could be hugely significant on the battlefield. You know, $40 billion, that brings the U.S. Contribution to the Ukraine war effort to something like $53 billion. By contrast, the entire military budget of Russia is something like $66 billion. So not that far off. This is a huge package. I think there's a consensus on the Hill, although there is, there are some Rand Paul and others who disagree, but there is a consensus that this is money well spent now to help the Ukrainians fight off the Russians, that it's better to spend $40 billion now than to have to spend so much more at some later point with a more unfavorable geopolitical solution situation in Europe. So yeah, it's amazing. This, you know, bipartisan agreement on $40 billion. Who'd have thunk it?
Right. Who'd have thunk it? Now, that being said, Josh, like I said, it's another $40 billion on top of other multi-billion-dollar aid packages for Ukraine. Are there any signs that the American people might be getting a little weary of all those billions going to Ukraine, going to another country when there are pressing issues here at home?
Well, certainly, Jonathan. I mean, first of all, we should be clear that billions within that total aren't going to Ukraine at all. They're going to mitigate the global food crisis, the global energy crisis, and all the other global crises that are second and third degree effects. It's an acknowledgement by the Biden administration, and I wouldn't say a consensus, but at least a majority in both parties, that this Russia-Ukraine war is not really just about Russia-Ukraine, and we're seeing the effects everywhere. And so that's one thing. And, you know, what really shocked me actually about the vote was not that it passed, was that 57 Republicans and 11 in the House and 11 Republicans in the Senate voted against it, you know, on this idea that, oh, well, we have to choose between helping Americans and helping people abroad, which is a false choice, which frankly used to be confined to the Rand Paul restrained crowd, but now includes people like Senator Bill Hagerty, who was the U.S. ambassador to Japan and, you know, in my opinion, knows better, you know, if you catch my drift. And so why are they doing this? Because Heritage Action and the money in the Republican Party is now moving towards that more restraint isolationist foreign policy Tucker Carlson view. And the politicians follow the money. And sure, you know, the majority of Republicans made a very simple point, which is $40 billion now is a lot cheaper than World War III if Russia wins. It seems pretty simple. And, you know, it's a shame that a lot more Republicans aren't willing to explain that to their constituents.
Right. Exactly. All right. We've got less than 5 minutes left, and I've got two questions I have to get in. Gene, yesterday the president welcomed the president of Finland and the prime minister of Sweden to the White House to champion their membership application to NATO. And yet Turkey, President Erdogan is like, I'm not for this. Yeah. Is there anything, what will it take to get over Turkey's objections to allow for those for Finland and Sweden to officially become members of NATO?
Well, the administration and frankly the other major members of NATO seem to think it will take bribing Erdogan in some way. Sweden and Finland, I think, are not prepared to do what he wants to do, which would be potentially hand over to Turkey dissidents and who Lord knows what would happen to them if Erdogan got his hands on them. And he calls them terrorists, and so this is his ostensible reason for saying I'm going to block this. The administration and the Brits and the French seem to think that Erdogan can be brought around, perhaps with other favors that they can do for him short of. Of asking, to put the lives of these dissidents in jeopardy by sending them home.
Right. And Josh, final question to you. As we are having this conversation right now, the president of the United States is over in Asia. He is in Korea, basically sending a message to the region that the United States values the relationships. You have a column out where you're specifically writing about China and the incredible effort, lobbying effort, all sorts of things to get the United States to remove the tariffs on China that were instituted by Donald Trump. And you say that that's a bad idea, even if it means lowering prices here in the United States. Real quickly, why?
Right. Well, the Treasury Department, Wall Street, and the Chinese government have teamed up to try to convince Biden to drop Trump's China tariffs under the false claim that it would lower inflation and help consumers. But what I pointed out is that it actually wouldn't have any measurable effect on the economy at all, at much less inflation, and that what it would do is give the Chinese government a huge unearned concession that it has been bargaining for. And that if Biden does that now, that would come at, of course, the worst possible time as he's in Asia trying to prove to our Asian allies that his administration is tough on China. But this is not a new argument. This is how Wall Street has always viewed the tariffs, and they're just using the latest economic crisis to try to trick Biden into doing what they always wanted him to do. But the labor unions, on the other hand, are warning the president that if he loosens his grip on tough economic measures vis-a-vis China, that comes at the expense of American workers, and he'll pay that price in November with Democrats as well. And I think they're right, and I think the national security officials are right, which is that, this is not the time to give China a concession. This is the time to protect American businesses and to realize that China's economy is going south because its dictator is going crazy, and that means we have to disentangle ourselves from China and not get deeper into that risky dictatorship mess.
I think in that fight between Wall Street and the labor unions, I think I know which side President Biden would choose. Josh Rogan,
so
Eugene
sure.
Robinson, we are...
I'm not so sure either.
We'll see.
We are out of time. Thanks for coming on First Look. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks for listening. To always stay up to date with First Look, subscribe to Washington Post Live's First Look on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.